Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to share some of my takeaways from the recent Primal Skills Camp that I hosted a few weeks ago and share with you those, the three main things that I learned while working with the four riders who came over the course of 2 days that I think will help you as well and kind of help speed up your fitness and skill development as a rider. And and then also as part of that, I have a quick review of the stand-up bike that I have been using for the last few weeks. I actually got a chance to use it as part of the skills camp, so wanted to share some of my feedback on that and how I've been using that to help riders get a better feeling for some important skills on their bike. But before that, I wanted to take care of some basic housekeeping stuff, I guess, if you want to call it that. Just want to share a few things. I do have a new workout of the month that I sent out at the beginning of the month. And so if you haven't signed up for that yet, you can go to bikejames.com. Just sign up for the right there. When you go there, there's a sign up box that you can use and you'll get an intro workout with that. And so just want to make sure that you guys are taking advantage of that resource if you're not already. The other thing is along with that, I have created what I call my underground skills training handbook. And what this after I started training riders, after a few years, I started to realize that I needed to get better at helping them with the skill side as well. Because basically, what you're doing on the bike is just a combination of basic human movements. And as a strength coach, I was helping people move better off of their bike, and then I was just kind of turning it over to somebody who didn't necessarily understand human movement to show them how to apply movement to the bike. And so I was seeing a lot of disconnect between what people were told to do through, basic, your common like skills training outlets, and what I knew to be the right way to move from just a basic human movement standpoint. And so, starting several years ago, I started writing articles and doing videos and podcasts covering the skills training side of stuff. And basically, at the heart of it is showing you how to apply good human movement to the bike. And so, that's basically at the heart of everything that I do with MTB Skills Training Systems, is help you move better off of the bike and then show you how to apply that better movement to the bike. And so I had created a pretty sizable collection over the years of different, articles, videos, podcasts, things like that. And I kept referring people to these when I would get questions like, oh, check out this article on cornering, or check out this one on, hand position or whatever. And so what I decided to do was sit down and put together all of these articles and stuff into one resource. And so that's basically what the Underground Skills Training Handbook is. And I chose that name because these are kind of the underground skills training techniques that you're not going to learn at your average skills training camp or resource. And basically, because I come at this from a completely different angle than your average skills coach does, who doesn't really look at how are you moving and then do we need to fix movement? Is this a movement issue? Is this a skill issue? They come at it from the skill side first and then try to reverse engineer the movement for that, rather than coming at it from the movement side first and then applying that movement to the bike. And it seems like a subtle, but it is a major difference in how you go about trying to explain skills movement and also how you help riders improve their skills. Because again, if they're not moving well, then it's not a skill problem. And so you have to have some sort of solutions to help riders move better so that they can then actually start to work on the skill problem. If you have bad movement and you're having trouble with a skill, then you're not able to move properly in the first place. And that needs to be the first thing that you fix. So just like trying to fix bad movement with the 10 points of whatever, insert skill here, is not the right way to go about it. So I put together this resource, and you can go to bikejames.com I posted it a few weeks ago. Or you can also just when you sign up, if you haven't done it already, when you sign up for the workout out of the month, you also get a copy of this as well. So easy for you to access. But if you haven't gotten it yet, go check that out. And then kind of related to that, I do have a post I put up earlier this week on how your hand position affects jumps and drops. And again, I really encourage you to go check that one out. I've really started to put some pieces together with, you know, how your hand position can negatively affect how you move on the bike, and especially if your hands are too wide. And there is a sweet spot that you want your hands in. And, you know, this is not just a matter of opinion or personal riding styles or any of these other things that get kind of thrown around when you start talking about these things. And instead of saying, no, look, this is a standard that we can use to help us figure out what the best thing is and how do we individualize that advice for each person. And so basically that's what a lot of the stuff, you know, some of the posts I've been putting up lately have been covering. And this one in particular, because I still get some questions from people about, you know, well, don't wider hands help you absorb jumps and drops and, you know, do downhill and kind of that more aggressive side of riding. And so if you think that that is the case, you definitely need to go check this post out so you can see what the truth is. And again, I got a test for you that you can use to test for yourself and see what your own personal hand width should be for optimally absorbing impacts on the trail. And so anyways, just a lot of good stuff lately that I've gotten posted. Want to make sure that you guys are taking advantage of all of that. So with all that said, let's get into the recap of the Primal Skills Camp. And the three things that I took away, I'm going to go over, you know, just touch on the three things and then get into each one a little bit. But number one was the importance of isometric training for developing strength. Number two is the importance of having weight on your hands to drive your movement on the bike. And the third one is the importance of mobility training if you want to quote unquote ride for a lifetime. And this is something, a term that I've started to use to describe this bigger goal that a lot of us have that goes beyond just, you know, riding faster today, and how do we actually set ourselves up for success so that we can do this for the long run as well. So the first one is the importance of isometric training for developing strength. And I've been hammering, really, I guess maybe not hard enough, on the importance of isometric training over the last few months. And really, the more I get into it, the more I realize that it's not optional. Like if you're not using isometric training as a significant part of your training program, then you are really missing out on strength development. And at the heart of it is a realization that I've had that what makes up strength? Like what is the atomic element of strength, right? Like if you were to, you know, try to dissect strength and figure out, well, what composes strength? Everyone's like, well, you need to get stronger. Okay, cool. Well, what composes strength? What is strength? And if you were to, you know, take it down to its elemental nature, strength is really about tension. It is about your ability to create and control tension. And the better that you can do that, the more strength potential that you have. And so there's two parts to tension. One is how efficiently you can create it. And another way of looking at this is your what's called your recruitment pattern, right? So how does your body recruit muscles in order to create a movement or create tension within a movement? And this is both, one, it's like what is the order that they're recruited in, which ones are turned on and to what degree, but another part of this recruitment pattern is also which ones aren't turned on, which ones are actually inhibited and relaxed so that they don't interfere with the ability to create tension in the more important muscles. And so it's not all about just creating a ton of tension throughout the entire body. It's actually about creating intentional tension, I guess, is the way to look at it. And so that is what your recruitment pattern is your ability to recruit the right muscles in the right order make sure that you're not recruiting the wrong muscles. And the more efficiently you can do that, the more efficiently you are you're creating tension within a movement pattern. And then also you can look at the specific muscles within that movement pattern. And as when you get into that, you start to look at, well, how much tension can I generate? This is the second part of strength, is how much tension, how high a level of tension can you generate in a muscle? And then also how much tension can you generate within the muscle as it's coordinating with the other muscles for creating a movement or creating tension within a movement. And so this skill of creating tension is one thing. And then your ability to apply that tension to a movement, this is a different skill. And so if you are trying to get stronger, then you have to be working on this ability to create tension. That is the whole point. If you're lifting weights, you're trying to work on your muscles' ability to create and control tension. You're using a movement-based method to do it, but at its heart, that is what strength is. If you're getting stronger in a lift, you are creating more tension and or you are getting better at recruiting the muscles to create that movement. You're getting more efficient at that. And so both of these things lead to strength and also endurance gains. Like, this is the more efficiently you can move, the better your endurance within that movement pattern is going to be. And so this recruitment pattern and your ability to create high levels of tension are that elemental nature of strength. If you were to break strength down to its atomic elements, that is what you would find. And so the best ways to work on those two things are, without a doubt, isometric training. If you look at the research, it's not even close. Isometric training is the best way to improve your recruitment pattern, and it is the best way to improve your ability to create tension. And so, you know, if you put yourself in a position, if you get down into the bottom position of a squat and you challenge yourself to hold that position for 60 to 90 seconds, basically a minute to a minute and a half, what you'll find is that your body is going to fight to have to find a better, more efficient way to hold that position. Like, a lot of people experience their muscles shaking while doing, or not really muscles, well, muscles and also their limbs, like their body starts to shake while doing isometric training, especially as they fatigue. And this is literally your body trying to figure out a more efficient way to use your muscles and body structure to create tension and hold itself in this position. And this is only possible when you have introduced yourself to these high levels of fatigue that's caused the body to have to find a better way to do it. You have to fatigue out the inefficient muscles so that your body has to figure out a better way to hold itself and create tension within this position and this movement pattern. And so, again, like, that is when you're using movement-based training and you're trying to accumulate reps to do that, it takes a lot longer. Again, the science backs this up, and just the common sense, if you think about it as well. Like, if you're holding yourself in the bottom position of a squat for 90 seconds, like, you're under tension in that position for 90 seconds. You're not creating movement, so you're not having to worry about getting hurt, right? So that injury potential isn't there. But it would take you so many squats and you holding that bottom position for an amount of time each time to add up to having 90 seconds time under tension in that position, right? So it's not just time under tension. It's also time under tension in a position. And so the more time under tension that you spend in a position, then the stronger that position is going to be. And so if you have the weak link there, and a lot of times people's ability to hold themselves well and efficiently in the bottom of a position or in that weak link point is at the heart of it. Like, if you think about it, people hate hanging out at the bottom of their squat. They want to get out of there. And why is that? Well, they can get down there and they can get out of there, but they're in such a bad position at the bottom that they can't hold themselves there very efficiently. And so they'll bang out their reps and they look like they're getting stronger and doing better, but you're not actually improving your recruitment pattern and how you're moving, because you've never really introduced yourself to these levels of fatigue that you need in order to do that. And then also on the flip side of that is if you were doing a squat and you had, you know, the way that I like to recommend is you get a jiu-jitsu belt and you wrap it around your waist and you step on it. So basically you can get into the bottom position of the squat. And then imagine that you're trying to jump off of the floor. You know, you're doing a squat to stand up and the belt stops you from standing up, right? And so you driving into that belt and trying to break the belt, as I put it, that allows you to create higher levels of tension within your muscles than you can create doing movement-based training. Again, the studies back this up, common sense backs this up, but the highest levels of tension that you can produce are through isometric training, period. It's not even close. And so if your ability to create tension within a position is important because for strength, then again, what allows us to create the highest levels of tension, isometric training. So when you are looking at getting stronger, and especially if we're talking about getting stronger in the context of an athlete. So we're mountain bikers. So we don't want to just get stronger in the gym. We want to get stronger in a way that translates to our bike. So we want to get strong in a way that also makes us efficient, because we need efficiency, endurance side of it as well. And so just lifting more weight but not doing it efficiently isn't necessarily what we want. But on the flip side, we need strength. Like as mountain bikers, we require the highest levels of tension of almost any cycling sport. And so you need that ability to create tension. And so, you know, you need both of these things. And so if you need to develop strength in a way that is allowing you to develop both of these things as you're doing it. And so, again, just as I was preparing for the camp and kind of putting some of my thoughts together, and then also talking to the guys that came to the camp and sharing the stuff with them and answering their questions, and then also taking them through these workouts and showing them the power of the isometrics and how it's able to quickly improve how you feel and how efficiently you're able to create a movement and how you feel within that movement. And that it really just, you know, hammered home for me the importance of the isometric training. So, you know, I actually have a program out, my Ramping Isometrics program. I'm getting ready to revamp it and start to incorporate a lot more stuff that I've been doing lately, and actually a true full training system based on isometric training. And so, you know, definitely want to keep an eye out for that. But it's really got me excited just as I think about the potential for this for riders, just seeing the impact it's had on my training and riding and the riders that I've been working with this stuff. And just as I get into it more and I see the research and I understand some of the pitfalls, I guess, some of the reasons that isometric training got confusing and difficult for people to use. And then if it's difficult and you don't understand it and it's confusing, you're not going to use it. And so it's so much easier to just go grab some weights and lift some weights than it is to try and employ isometric training as it's currently used by most people, or try to, you know, explain to most people. And so what I'm hoping to do is create a training system that makes isometric training like super easy, super available for, you know, you to do, as far as like it being, easy, straightforward, something you can do by itself, and also something you can incorporate with other workouts. So, but anyways, yeah, isometric training, man, if you're not using it as part of your training program, you're really, really, really missing out. And it's so easy to add in. It has this anyways, yeah, I'll be touching up more on it as I get closer to releasing the program. But there's just so many positive things that come from it. It's just had such a huge impact on my own training and results lately that I really want to, get excited when I think about sharing this stuff with everybody. So moving on to my second takeaway, though. So once we get past the strength training stuff, what was my big takeaway from the skills training side of stuff was having weight on your hands. And as I get into this more, I realize that the advice of light hands, heavy feet is probably the worst advice that has ever come into the mountain biking world. And there's a lot of really, really, really bad advice being thrown around out there. But some of the worst, I think, number one is light hands, heavy feet. And now I'm one of the culprits who helped spread this. I mean, I used to teach this. If you guys go to bikejames.com and you know, search back long enough, I'm sure you can drag up an article or find a video or something that I did where I actually advise light hands, heavy feet, and you know, tell people that's the goal. But the problem is we need to understand, like, what do we really want on the bike? You know, where did that advice come from? What's going on here? And so for me, one of the big things that I've been realizing lately with my own riding and just working with other riders is that you need to have pressure on the front tire. I've mentioned this a couple times in passing, but one of the things that you need to realize is that you are trying to solve a pressure problem on your bike. It's very important that you solve the right problem. What is the problem that you're trying to solve? And you need to have, and so if you want to have traction on your tires, it's not weight. Weight is not the problem, it's pressure. And pressure and weight are intimately tied to each other, but they're not necessarily the same thing. And, you know, the easiest example to think of with this is that if you stand on a bathroom scale, you know, especially one of the old school ones that have the rotary readout that spins around and tells you your weight, you stand on it and it spins to the weight that you're at, right? So like right now I weigh 165 pounds and it would say 165 pounds. And then if I was to, you know, not jump, but just like get light and then like stomp, like get my feet heavy, apply pressure basically through my feet into the scale, you'll see the scale move. You know, my weight didn't change. I'm still the same 165 pounds. But I can make that weight register more than 165 pounds through active use of my weight. And so pressure is the active use of your weight. It's not weight. Dead weight presents its own problems. But if you're using weight to create pressure, well, that's a different thing. And so if you're looking at the bike and you're trying to solve weight problems, you're like, you need weight on your tires and you don't want weight on your hands and you're using the word weight a lot, you may be solving the wrong problem and you may be actually taking away from your ability to solve the true problem, which is pressure. And so you need to have weight on your hands, but you don't want just dead weight, right? And this is where the problem comes from is people, one, like, where did the advice originally come from? Well, it originally came from road motorcycle training school. Okay, so like, remember, originally there was no mountain bike skills training. So the guys who pioneered this stuff, they didn't really have anyone to look to say, well, how do we coach mountain biking skills? And so what they did is they started looking around to other sports that had an established skills training system that they thought that they could go to and start to apply stuff from that to mountain biking. And one of these was motorcycle riding, and in particular riding on like street bikes. And if you go to a training camp or training school that teaches you how to ride street bikes, they're going to tell you that you don't want a lot of weight on your hands, that you want light hands. I call them ghost fingers or something. Again, that was the term that was being used to describe this back when I was around and this was first starting to come up. And I think it's still something that's used today. But the idea was that you wanted as little weight on your hands as possible so that you could let the speed and momentum of the bike steer you. And too much weight on the hands would actually interfere with that. And so, that's great for a street bike, but we're not riding a street bike, right? We're on a mountain bike. And so that advice, you know, the principles behind it are the same, but the specific method is not going to be the same. The specific method that you use to apply pressure through your hands into a street bike is not going to be the same as what you use to apply pressure through your hands on a mountain bike. And so on a mountain bike, you need pressure on your front end. It's very important that you have a lot of pressure on your front end because your front tire is your main, like, that's what's steering you on the trail. If your front tire is not tracking and doesn't have traction, you're not going anywhere. And so your rear tire, on the other hand, you know, we've all had times when it got loose. And if your front tire's gotten through something and your rear tire gets loose, the rear tire will like pull itself back in. So if you got to put money down on which one of your two tires you want to make sure gets through a corner or gets through something, it's your front tire. If your front tire gets through, you're through it for the most part. If your front tire doesn't get through it, but you still got good weight and pressure and stuff on your rear tire, well, then that's not what we want. And so when you are on a mountain bike, you need that weight and pressure on your hands. Like, in fact, I remember having this, you know, discussion with one of the skills coaches that I was learning this stuff from, because he's telling me, I don't want any weight on my hands. And I'm like, but there's something there. Like, I can't stand up on my bike. I can't corner without feeling something on my hands. I can't have no weight on my hands. What is that I'm feeling? What is going on there? And his response was, well, look, I don't know. This is just what the best, you know, motorcycle coaches in the world teach. So take it up with them. And it's like, holy crap, man. Like, I understand that, but I need to be able to explain this to people. If I'm going to go talk to people and try and explain this to people, then I can't just fall back on that excuse. And so through the course of discussion, we actually came up with the term pressure, like having pressure at your hands. And so, again, that's kind of spread through. You do hear this term some. And I actually wrote an article on Pink Bike many years ago on this exact topic. And I coined the term purposeful pressure because, you know, you don't want weight on your hands, but you need pressure. And to have pressure, you have to have weight. So you have to have weight on your hands if you want to have pressure on your hands. And you need pressure on your hands if you want to steer, especially with cornering, but just a lot of things that happen on your bike are going to be initiated through hand pressure. And if you don't have any weight on your hands, you cannot apply pressure through your hands. So, you know, again, it seems subtle, but it's a huge, huge difference, because I'm watching these the riders that I'm working with at this camp. You know, we're going out on the bikes and they have gotten very good at keeping as little weight on their hands as possible. But when I tell them, okay, but you need to be able to apply pressure through your hands for this skill or that skill or to move this way on the bike, they weren't able to do it. They weren't able to create the movements that I needed them to because they didn't have any pressure through their hands. And you have to be able to create pressure through your hands and your feet. Those are your two main contact points with the bike. And so your ability to create purposeful pressure through those contact points are what drives your bike, is what keeps you on your bike, helps you pedal your bike, helps you execute skills on your bike. Everything that happens on your bike is a result of hand and foot pressure. Unless you're sitting down and using your crotch as another pressure point, which I don't advise, you know, which is why I, you know, don't advise using high tension seated pedaling a lot, because you know, you're requiring that wedge of you're making a wedge out of your crotch or you know, creating a pressure point there when you don't necessarily need it. So you need, but the hands and the feet are your primary pressure points that you need to, that you have on the bike. And so people are so scared to put weight on their hands because of this, you know, oh, heavy hands or, you know, light hands, heavy feet advice. And they're so skilled at just sitting down in this deep attack position and they just live there. They just sit there. Because when you're in this deep attack position, you have a bunch of weight shifted back, and it makes it easier to keep weight on your feet and weight off of your hands. But the problem is, if you don't have weight on your hands, you're not going to be able to steer. Your front brake isn't going to be as effective. Like, there's a lot of, if you don't have weight on your hands, that's also an indicator that you are behind the bike. And so if you're going to push the bike in front of you to lift your front wheel or to do a drop or something like that, you have to be in front of the bike for you to push the bike in front of you. And if you're standing up with your weight in front of the bike, I guarantee you that you're going to have weight on your hands. There's no way to get your weight in front of the bike without having weight on your hands. And so, but if you don't have your weight in front of the bike, you're not going to be able to execute a lot of skills that you need to on the bike. And so just learning how to try to move from this dead attack position, right? Like, the attack position should be something that you're moving into and out of dynamically as needed, not a dead attack position where you're just living there and you're trying to just execute all of your skills from this the same basic hovering attack position. And so again, though, if your goal is to have light hands, heavy feet, then that's how you're going to do it, because you're solving that problem. You've created a problem, and now you've created a solution for that problem. But you've solved the wrong problem. The problem is, how do you create good pressure through your hands? And to do that, you need weight. And so you need weight on your hands. And so, in fact, some of the cues that I was using at the camp was put as much weight as possible on your hands. Like, I wanted them to weight the front end of their bike and get it heavy. And, you know, you see, like, people are like, oh my God, that's so dangerous. You're going to fly over the handlebars. And it's like, that's nonsense, right? You're only going to fly over the handlebars if there's something in front of you, right? Like, if you're pedaling down the street, there's nothing in front of you. You can stand up and get your weight in front of the bike, and you're not going to fly over the handlebars. And so you're like, on the trail, there are a lot of times when there is nothing in front of you. You are not in any imminent danger of flying over your handlebars. And when you do see danger coming, it's very easy to shift your weight back and actually use that weight shift to unweight your front end, which is safer and more dynamic than just sitting in this attack position and letting your unweighted front end just run into stuff. All right. So, you know, my point is that without being able to get that weight in front of your hands or your weight on your hands and get that weight in front of the bike, it's super difficult to execute skills on your bike. And if you start to think about it, you realize that I don't have to be sitting in this attack position, which is basically like the example that I use is, if you've ever been trail running before and you've tripped over a rock, right? Like, that sucks. But the answer wasn't to lean backwards and run, right? If you have your weight leaning backwards and you're running, you're not going to trip, but you're not going to run very well, right? The answer was to assess, like, whoa, wait a minute, what happened there? I didn't see that rock. I need to look more. I didn't shift, as you approach stuff where you can trip, you do need to shift your weight back and not have your weight leaning forward as much when you're running. And so the same thing on your bike, right? Like, just because you went over the handlebars once doesn't mean you want to start riding with your weight always shifted back. Like, that takes away from your ability to be dynamic and athletic on the bike. And so learn how to scan the terrain, learn how to, use your weight shifts as needed, from front to back, instead of just hanging out in the attack position. And to do that, though, you need to get weight on your hands. So anyways, I know I'm kind of like beating a dead horse here, but I can't emphasize enough. If you do nothing else from this podcast, go out on the trail, stand up and put some weight on your hands and just see what happens, right? I bet you'll be surprised at how much it opens up for you as far as your ability to corner and unweight the front end and sprint and your vision and just all the things that you want on the trail really open up when you get your weight forward and get some weight on your hands and use weight shifts more dynamically rather than just sitting in this dead attack position. So I will leave that one alone. I'm sure I'm going to have way more to say about that in future posts. But on to the third takeaway for me. And that was the importance of mobility training if your goal is to ride for a lifetime. And that was one of the interesting things that I took away from this camp, is that all four of the riders who showed up had very similar goals, in that they weren't racers. Like, performance wasn't their primary goal. Their primary goal was to figure out a sustainable way to train that will allow them to continue to ride for a lifetime, basically. You know, as you start to approach 40, you get into your 40s and 50s, you start to realize that if you're not proactive about it, it's very easy for you to lose your ability to ride at a decent level. That the advantages of youth are wasted on the young, and that your physical attributes start to decline, especially if you do nothing to try to stop it, and that just riding your bike is not enough. You can get away with that in your 20s and early to mid 30s, but once you hit 40, you realize that you are not going to be able to get away with just riding your bike. You have to do something else, or else you're going to just, you're, like I said, something's going to happen. You're going to get hurt from like an overuse injury. You're just going to like riding bike. Your bike isn't going to be any fun anymore because you, your performance declines to the point that you're just basically able to ride, you know, dirt roads, and you can't really challenge yourself anymore. And so no one wants that. Like, so how do we avoid that? And that was, again, the guys at the camp range from like late 30s to early 60s and in between there. And that was that one common thread was, how do I get a training program that helps me sustain this for the long term? And the first element with that I already touched on was isometric training. And I won't, you know, beat that one again, because I think I touched on that one enough earlier. But your isometric training is the first key to that. And the second one is mobility training. And, you know, there's one of the things that I've noticed with, I guess, in being in the fitness industry, you know, I'm in an interesting position because, one, I'm in the fitness industry, so I go to conferences and I go to workshops and I go to things that people that I look up to are doing. And then I also have the opportunity to host those things and have people that look to Bike James for help and information, them come and work with me. And so it's an interesting view that I have of the fitness industry, both being going to these things and then also hosting these things. But either way, I've noticed that mobility training is just kind of one of these things that we really pay lip service to when it comes to training. Everyone's like, yeah, I know I need to do it. No, I've seen that stretch. I've done that before. And then it's like, all right, well, now let's do it. Let's get into the, you know, let's rubber hits the road and let's, you know, run through these positions. Let's do these movements. Let's do this, you know, these mobility, this mobility routine here. And you quickly see that there is not as much time being spent in that area as there should be. And so it's however much mobility training you're doing, you need to be doing more. And like personally, I probably do 70 to 80% of my training I would classify as mobility-based training or things to work on soft tissue, things like, you know, the foam roller or the boom stick or some of these other tools that I've been getting into lately. But the recovery side, mobility and keeping my movement quality high is the bulk of my training. And when I was younger, that wasn't it. It was flipped, right? Like 80%+ of my training was strength training and cardio and things that were hard. And I had lip service basically being paid to the mobility side of things. And it was only through my own trial and error and learning things the hard way, you know, both, you know, getting injuries that were threatening to keep me from doing the things that I loved and also working with people that had these same issues, that I really started to realize that the mobility training is got to be the primary thing. Like 51%+ of your training, especially if you're in the 40+ category, needs to be mobility training. And I would say that for everyone, right? But like seriously, honestly, I know 20-year-old knuckleheads ain't listening to me. So just keep doing what you want. And it's great, man. I love, 20-year-old me was a moron, but I love that dude. He was a madman. And so you 20-year-olds are madmen or mad women, right? Like have at it. Like you guys will come to me eventually because you will realize that what I'm saying was right. And you should have been spending way more time and effort on this stuff on the front end rather than having to try to fix it on the back end. But I just know how these things go. So that's why I'm kind of directing this more towards that 40-plus crowd. But yeah, once you get to that point, you definitely got to be doing more mobility than strength and cardio training. It has to be taking the centerpiece. And again, you got to remember too, riding your bike is the best training you can do. I've talked about this a lot of times, that one of the biggest mistakes riders make is not looking at their riding as cardio training. So they'll be riding their bike and they're trying to do cardio training and they're trying to do strength training. And it's like, dude, that leaves no time for mobility training. And so if you're doing that, you're like that double cardio is not necessary. If you're riding your bike, I would say like 2 to 3 times a week, you need to be doing minimal extra cardio and really devoting that extra time to your mobility training and stuff. And so, but this, it was interesting because I had a conversation with a guy, a friend of mine at jiu-jitsu, a couple weeks ago, and he's a younger guy, you know, early 20s, but I've known him. He's been coming here. He's from Brazil, came here to go to school. You know, he's been doing jiu-jitsu since he came here. It's funny. He's the Brazilian who does jiu-jitsu when he's here in the States, but then when he's in Brazil, he doesn't do jiu-jitsu. But anyways, he's a funny kid. But the thing is, you know, I've known him for a while. So when I first met him, he's 18, 19 years old, just, you know, recovers from anything, you know, just everything is, you know, he's a young dude. He's just got all those attributes and everything's great. And fast forward a few years and we were talking and he was talking about how stiff he felt and how he felt like he was really starting to lose his range of motion and his ability to move. And I was talking to him. I said, hey man, you know, it's funny because this is what I tell people, like the first sign of getting older, right? It's not, oh, I feel weaker. Oh, my cardio is going. No, you wake up and you're stiff. He's like, yeah. I mean, and, you know, he's right in it. He's like, a couple years ago, he could do almost anything and wake up the next day and just be like, bounce back and ready to go. But the first thing that makes you feel old is you wake up and you're like, oh my God, I feel stiff. And you're trying to move and you're like, you can't get all the way down or, you know, through your full range of motion. And so that mobility, that is the fountain of youth. Like that's that first domino that starts to fall. And as it falls, it affects everything else because as your mobility goes, that affects your ability to move efficiently. Well, that's going to affect your strength and that's going to affect your cardio. And so all of these other things are directly tied to your mobility. And so especially if you want to be doing this for a lifetime, as you get older, that mobility factor is that foundation for everything else that you do. And like the best way to think about it is you have things that add tension to the system and you have things that take away tension from the system. And you need to have some sort of balance between those things. And if you look at your not just your training program, but just your life, you'll see that we have way more things that add stress to our system than take away from it. And so you definitely don't want to be adding to that imbalance through your own training program. And so, definitely need to be making sure that you're spending. I mean, for me, I spend, you know, at least 15 minutes a day. It's just a habit, like at least 15 minutes a day doing some sort of mobility or soft tissue work. And then I have a longer routine that I do a couple times a week as well. And so anywhere from like half an hour to an hour. And I'm doing some sort of mobility work every day. I'm only doing strength training stuff, and the cornerstone of that is isometrics, 2 to 3 times a week. And so I'm definitely spending, you know, I'm spending like less than 3 hours a week doing strength training, and I am spending, you know, probably 10 hours a week doing mobility training stuff and soft tissue based stuff. And but again, like I feel like if I don't have that imbalance, then the imbalances that my regular life and training and everything else create in my system are going to cause problems. And I'm speaking from experience both with myself and with other riders that I've worked with. So make sure that you guys are doing more. Whatever you're doing, I can almost guarantee you that you need to be doing more. So those were my three big takeaways. You know, isometric training for developing strength, the importance of having weight on your hands to drive your movement on the bike, and then the importance of mobility training if you want to quote unquote ride for a lifetime, and making sure you're making that a big part of your program, especially as you get over that 40 plus mark. So kind of in the same thing here, not really one of my takeaways, but I kind of wanted to do a review, I guess if you want to call it that, of the M-Sub, the stand-up bike, the mountain bike version of the stand-up bike. And I had posted something on Instagram. I think I might have mentioned, you know, once or twice that I'd gotten one of these things. But long story short, I got approached by the company Elliptigo. If you guys have seen those bikes, it looks like an elliptical trainer and a bike had a baby. Like, so that's Elliptigo. And they have a new, they call it the stand-up bike. And it's the same concept, but instead of having the elliptical footbeds and stuff, it's mountain bike cranks or bicycle cranks. You've got gears and you know, so it looks more like a bike than it's a stand-up bike as opposed to like an elliptical bike. And I got approached by these guys because they had seen some of the stuff that I had written on stand-up pedaling. I'm a huge fan of stand-up pedaling. I think that it is your most important position to work on and develop as a rider. And so obviously there's some carryover between my views on stand-up pedaling and how it's better and actually healthier for your body and what they're trying, the message they're trying to spread with this stand-up bike. And the stand-up bike came around, the elliptical bike came around because a guy lost his ability to run. I think his knees went out. And so he tried cycling. He didn't like cycling because it didn't feel like running to him. And he tried the elliptical trainer and he liked that, but he didn't like that he was indoors. And so that was literally the idea for the elliptical bike was, how do I get an elliptical trainer experience outdoors? And so that was the, like I said, the motivation for them creating the bike, and they're trying to help people understand some of the benefits. And so I was looking at it and I talked them into sending me one to check out, and I've been extremely impressed with it. I really like my bike. I've had several people try it. Everyone who tries it gets off with a big smile on their face. It is amazingly fun to ride. And again, people are like, you try to imagine what it feels like based on your own experience. Like, whoa, it's just like standing up on my bike. And it's not. It feels nothing like standing up on your regular bike. Similar, but not the same. And the reason is because it has you positioned so that when you're standing up, you have your weight positioned in the over the front end. And so I was touching earlier about the importance of having weight on your hands to drive the movement on the bike. And so this bike, the stand-up bike, basically puts you in this position. And so it feels very natural to stand up. And you don't feel like you want to sit down at all. Like, that's the thing. People are like, oh, I'm going to forget there's no seat there and kill myself. But there is no, I guess the way I explain it is like, when you look at your regular bike, right? Like, again, I know this isn't technically your bike's center of gravity, but if you look at your bike's bottom bracket, right? And imagine that as being a dividing point for your bike. And so, you know, towards the rear wheel from there is, you know, what we would call like the back of the cockpit is what I call it. And towards the front wheel from there is what I call the front of the cockpit. And so your bike, as it's set up right now, is basically biased with to have the weight set up in the back of the cockpit. Like, people make bikes assuming that you're going to be sitting down a lot. And if you're sitting down, well, your hips and your weight are behind the bike's center of gravity. And so you're in that back of the cockpit position. And so when you stand up and you go to that front of the cockpit position and you do find that balance point up there, there's still that kind of, I call it like a gravitational pull for your butt towards the back of the bike, because it is set up biased towards you having your weight back there. Well, there is no back of the cockpit on the stand-up bike. It is all front of the cockpit. So when you're standing up, there is no gravitational pull for your butt at all. Like, you don't feel any need to sit down because it feels so natural to be standing up in that position. And so I actually used it at the camp to help the riders get an idea for stand-up pedaling, because, again, like, people don't really understand what it's like to get your weight in front of the bike. Like, your weight and momentum should be in front of the bike's weight and momentum, not on top of it. And to do that, you have to get yourself into the front of the cockpit. And most riders, again, from this advice of light hands, heavy feet, are scared to put weight on their hands, which makes it impossible for them to really get into the front of the cockpit and get a feel for what that position feels like. And so I was using the stand-up bike to give people that feeling of, this is what I want you to feel when you get back on your bike. There, you can recreate this sensation on your bike now that you know that it's there. And so it really helped them get an idea of like this standing pedaling and having your weight projecting forward, you know, what that felt like. And so it helped them get on the bike and apply it better to their bike. And it's also really good for cornering as well, because you need to have weight on your hands to corner. The biggest mistake that I see riders make in cornering is that when they go to corner, they shift their weight back and they don't keep weight on their hands. And so they can't keep pressure through their front tire. Remember, you have to have weight on your hands to apply pressure through your front tire. And if you don't have pressure on your front tire, then you don't have traction. And if you don't have traction, then things aren't going well for you in a corner, right? So you need to have that. And so this bike kind of forces you to keep your weight forward as you're turning. And the irony is like, you don't even need to think about turning. Like, you just kind of like look where you're going, and the bike just starts turning itself, because once you have weight on the front end and you have good pressure through the front tire, it makes it super easy to turn and track through a corner. And so, again, it really helped them get a feeling for that. Now, you know, I personally ride this thing around like all the time. Like, I wouldn't take it on a trail ride. Like, they call it a mountain bike, but it's more of like a hybrid bike. You know, as a hardcore mountain biker, you will be underwhelmed with its trail capabilities. That's not what they're trying to sell it for. They actually have a road version. I mean, honestly, for most people, I would go with that. Like the M Sub, the mountain bike version, it has the knobby tires. It has, a front fork on it. You know, it's not the highest quality front fork by any stretch of the imagination, but it, you know, does smooth out a few little impacts. But basically, if you're going to take this thing on dirt roads or, like bike paths and stuff like that, like maybe some dirt bike paths, then you would be fine, right? I would not take this thing on a hard mountain bike trail. It's not what it's made for. But what it is going to great for is a training bike. Like, if you're looking for a plus one bike, like, honestly, I would say that you would get way more out of using this bike than you would a road bike for training. Like, using a road bike as a mountain biker for training makes no sense in the world. A road bike is more efficient than a mountain bike. You don't want to use something that's more efficient than your actual thing that you're using in your sport. You want something that's less efficient. That's what forces cardio and endurance gains, is inefficiency training. And so this bike, one, it is like 34 pounds, which it doesn't feel that heavy, because when you're standing up, the extra power that you're getting helps offset that. But the training that you're going to get from that, you're going to be training your standing pedaling position. And again, one of the things that I try to hammer into people's minds is that standing pedaling is a skill, and it has its own like endurance aspect. So your seated pedaling endurance is not going to transfer over to standing pedaling. If you want to get better at standing pedaling, you have to work on standing pedaling. And what better way to work on standing pedaling than a bike that's designed to stand up on all the time and optimize your standing pedaling position? And so it is a way better option, in my opinion, for training than a road bike would be for a mountain biker. So yeah, if you would going out and doing workouts and stuff on the stand up bike would give you way better crossover to your mountain bike than pounding out the same workout on a road bike would. And for a plus one bike, if you're looking for something to add to your stable, is definitely worth checking out, because again, as a training tool, both from the stand-up pedaling side and also the cornering side, I really can't emphasize enough how weirdly effective that bike has been for helping people get an idea of what cornering needs to feel like on their bike. And it's helped me personally with my own cornering and really highlighting for me how when I would corner one way, I would keep good pressure on my inside hand. But then when I went to corner the other way, I would lose that pressure. And you could definitely see in my cornering ability and how tightly I could hold a corner, how that was affecting me. And so using the stand-up bike helped me iron that out. And now I'm able to actually apply that better to my bike. So, just from a lot of different standpoints, I think the stand-up bike has a lot of potential for us as mountain bikers. And like I said, I think is a way better option for you than a road bike would be, which has basically nothing to do with mountain biking at all. So, I mean, if you're just going to go with like, hey, it's two wheels, I guess you could throw in the seat, right? But it's like, hey, the stand-up bike has two wheels too. I mean, just looking at a bike and saying, well, they ride a bike, so that must be good for me to use is not necessarily the best way to go about it. Looking at what are the specific demands that you have for your sport. Now, which tools can you use to work on that. So again, a road bike is one of the least options, like a BMX bike to work on your skills, a stand-up bike to work on your standing pedaling and your cornering stuff. And, you know, like these would be much better tools for you to use than a road bike, which is basically just works on your ability to sit and spin, which is one of the most worthless skills on a trail that you can have. So, like that's the easy part, right? Like it's your ability to stand up and hammer, your ability to execute skills. Like these are the things that separate really good riders from just kind of your average rider. And, you know, not to be too, negative, but your average rider is not very good. I mean, when I'm out there on the trail and I'm watching your average trail rider cruising around, like, it's the average skill level out there is not super high. And a lot of it is, just stems from really bad advice, like people sitting and spinning, people being afraid to put weight on their hands. It's not them, right? Like they're doing the best that they can with the crappy advice that they've been given. And so if they're given better advice and they're given training tools that helps them apply that advice, then I think that you'd see the skill level of your average rider go up quite a bit. But anyways, I think the stand-up bike is one of those tools that for our unique sport definitely holds a lot of potential. So that's about it. That's going to do it for my review and recap of the Primal Skills Camp weekend. Hopefully you guys got some usable stuff out of all of those ramblings there. On the way out, I do want to remind you to make sure you visit bikejames.com to sign up for the free workout of the month. Plus, I send out weekly training tips to help you improve your power, endurance, and skills on the trail. I've got podcasts there, more podcasts like this, videos, more blog posts, all sorts of other stuff. I've got all sorts of free workouts you can sign up for there. So I just, you know, I just want to help you enjoy riding more. And so I try to make sure I'm giving you guys good content and good stuff that you can use to do that. If you are interested in a training program, I'm having a special deal this month on the 15-minute trail rider tune-up workouts. These are my 15-minute workouts. I've got 28 of them, and it's pretty cool the way that they're set up, that you can work on different skills. So I have workouts that work on like your cornering movement and your body position movement and things like that. I have ones that work on specific problem areas, just ones that are just like general, workouts, and they don't require much equipment, just a kettlebell. I've got body weight ones, and they're all just 15 minutes, right? And so it's a great way to, if you're short on time, to keep your workout habit going. I'm reading this book, Atomic Habits, and it's one of the things that he talks about is even if you can't be perfect, right? Like the important thing is to keep the momentum going. And one of the easiest ways to start a new habit is to make it easy. And so what's an easier way to start a workout habit than 15-minute workouts, right? You don't have to start with an hour-long routine. Just get 15 minutes in a few times a week. So it's a great collection of workouts to help you from a bunch of different angles with your training. And so you can use the promo code TRTU19 at checkout, and you can save 50% off the 15-minute trail rider tune-up. So it's TRTU, like trail rider tune-up, 19. And if you don't remember that, shoot me an email and I'll send you the promo code if you need it. Save some money on some workouts if you are looking for something like that. And then finally, pedalinginnovations.com. That's my pedaling company. I created the Catalyst Pedal. Really, it was another kind of insight of mine. Like, why am I teaching people to move one way off of their bike and then telling them to move a different way on their bike? And so when you really look at the science and the movement principles behind foot position and pedal stroke, you see that your foot needs to be stabilized in three key areas. You need the big toe knuckle, the little toe knuckle, and the back end of the arch all need to be stabilized, creating a triangle of pressure that you can use to create movement and pressure through your foot. And so again, it's not about having weight on your heel or on the ball of the foot. It's about being able to put weight on either or to shift it as you want. Like really the argument for me is like, what is the argument against heel pressure, right? Like small pedals don't allow you to have heel pressure. And I'm not saying we need to take away pressure from the ball of the foot. I'm just saying we need to add heel pressure. Like, what's the argument against heel pressure? Like, anybody who knows anything about human movement knows that heel pressure is vital to just about everything that you do from a movement standpoint. And so so you need that heel pressure. The catalyst pedal is the only pedal that's designed to support your foot the way that nature intended. And it really helps improve your performance, helps take away aches and pains. It's crazy how many people we hear from on a weekly basis telling us that the catalyst pedal has taken away their knee pain, their low back pain, their hip pain, their ankle pain, their foot pain. There's so many problems that get created from having an unstable platform and an unstable foot. And then trying to create pressure and force through that that it causes for your body. That once you fix that, a lot of other things fall into place. So you're improving your performance and your comfort and all sorts of stuff. So make sure that you check out pedalinginnovations.com to learn more about the Catalyst pedal. And get the only pedal that lets your foot work the way that it's supposed to, not the way that the cycling industry tells you that it's supposed to. So do your research, people. Don't believe me. Look into it for yourselves, and I think you'll arrive at the same conclusion. So anyway, so that's going to do it for this episode of the Bike James Podcast. Appreciate you guys hanging out with me again, and I will talk to everybody next time.